Welcome to the Pro Politics Podcast. I'm Zach McCrary. I've been working in politics for the better part of two decades, but at heart, I'm a political junkie who wants to talk to interesting people involved in politics. Today, my guest is Charlie Black, who's worked at the top levels of both governmental affairs and Republican politics, going on his sixth decade. He got his start, inspired by Barry Goldwater, was instrumental in the conservative movement within the Republican Party in the 70s, was a top advisor to President Reagan, both Presidents Bush, and the Prime Policy Group, which he started as one of the real powerhouse lobbying firms in D.C. This is a really fun conversation with a titan of Republican politics. Charlie Black, tell me a bit how you grew up.
Well, I grew up in a sort of a lower middle class family in Wilmington, North Carolina. My father was a salesman and my mother was a stay-at-home mother. We didn't have a whole lot, but we didn't consider ourselves poor or anything like that. Went to public schools and ended up going to school at the University of Florida. Got a good education there, went a couple of years of law school there. Then I dropped out of law school to go work on a political campaign and eventually finish at night at American University.
It doesn't sound like you grew up in a household that was a professional political household, maybe not steeped in politics. What are some of your earlier political memories?
Well, my parents weren't very political. I mean, they were interested in politics and government a little bit, and they voted. But in those days, in the late 50s, early 60s in eastern North Carolina, everybody was a Democrat. So you cast an important vote in Democratic primaries, but that was about it. So they didn't talk about it too much. But in 1964, I was a senior in high school when Barry Goldwater ran for president. I took an interest in him. So did my parents. They were excited about Goldwater. Well, I got interested in that. And I even went to a rally, not with Goldwater, but with some Republicans. And most important thing is I read Goldwater's book, The Conscience of a Conservative. Loved that and loved his small government libertarian style approach. So that next year, when I the University of Florida, I'm motivated to join the Young Republicans and Young Americans for Freedom, which was a very large conservative youth organization in those days. And that really got me started in politics.
What was your approach? How did you get your foot in the door as an actual professional political operative?
During college and law school, I did a lot of volunteer work in campaigns, got very active in Young Americans for Freedom. So after my second year of law school, I was asked to come to Washington and work in the national office of YAF, Young Americans for Freedom. And I did. After about a year of that, one of our YAF advisory board members from my home state, a guy named Jesse Helms, was running for the U.S. Senate. And asked me in the spring of 1972 to come basically be his political director in the campaign. Well, no Republican had won a Senate seat in North Carolina, and most people thought it was impossible, but he was a good conservative, and I went and did it. And lo and behold, we did win. YAF was not only the youth wing of the conservative movement, but it produced a lot of volunteers and activists who worked in conservative campaigns. It was very much all over, not just college campuses, but also adult chapters. And there was a pretty big overlap between YAF and the Young Republicans, but not all Young Republicans were members of YAF. Among groups that could produce a lot of volunteers for a campaign on short notice, YAF was probably the best. And working for YAF, I had known Jesse Helms, who he was anyhow, and he came to Washington for his campaign, and we helped get him around town and get him the meetings he wanted and everything. And I guess he took a liking to me, so he asked me to come work for him.
And at the risk of antagonizing some of my more liberal listeners, can you talk about Jesse Helms, the political figure, the Senator Jesse Helms, you knew so well, an iconic Republican, often a boogeyman on the left?
He served 30 years in the Senate, which anybody, when he first was elected, a lot of people thought that was a fluke. He won on Nixon's coattails and he wouldn't win again, but he won five terms. The reason for that was he was a strong conservative. He was issue oriented. He worked on conservative issues in Congress, but he also looked after the state. He served on the Senate Agriculture Committee because agriculture was the biggest industry in the state, especially the tobacco industry in the eastern part of the state was huge in those days. And so he worked on those issues. He wanted to have great constituent service. I went back to Washington with him on his staff for about 3 years, and we emphasized constituent service. So yes, he was a conservative and he worked on conservative issues that might have offended some people. He also was a good senator and did the service to the state that was necessary to become popular, and he stayed popular. He was a great man. He was a very kind man. The Hill newsletter used to do surveys every year. Capitol staff, Capitol police, the people who ran the subways and all that, who was the nicest or kindest senator. And Helms almost every year won the award as the nicest senator, the kindest senator, the way he treated the staff up there. And that was true of his own staff, too. He had also been, in private life, a philanthropist. He spent a lot of time raising money for various charitable causes, including a historically Black university in North Carolina. Started a summer camp for disadvantaged children. So many of them who came to the camp were minorities. So a lot of the things that his detractors said about him didn't hold up under scrutiny.
People also associate pretty hard-edged, aggressive campaigns with Senator Helms. Do you think that's fair to say that he was at the cutting edge of those types of very aggressive campaign tactics? Is that a fair read?
Well, it probably is. And I was in on that. I think people say that because we did do a lot of negative advertising. He was not afraid to take on his opponents on the issues. He tried to be careful not to make personal attacks, but we probably did more negative advertising in the late 70s and 80s than a lot of people did, but we backed it up with facts and figures, and we never had to pull an ad because it was wrong. So a lot of times when you talk about aggressive tactics or negative ads, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and Democrats didn't like it.
As someone who I assume was a participant, what can you share about the 1984 titanic struggle between Senator Jesse Helms and a popular Democratic governor, Jim Hunt, in a race in 1984 that foreshadowed what big time Senate races were to become in the decades after?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I always thought it was the greatest Senate race ever run. It may still be. But Helms, of course, was by then finishing his second term, was a national figure, especially in the conservative Republican movement. And Hunt was a very popular governor, a very good guy, by the way. I got to know him in later years and thought a lot of him. We first ran a poll in January of 1983, and Jim Hunt was 22 points up on Jesse Helms. So we had to go raise a lot of money and chip away at Hunt's image, which his problem was he tried to avoid taking positions on a lot of federal issues. And when he did take positions on them, he'd usually come down on the left side. So we had to do a lot of ass to sort of smoke him out, goad him into taking a position. Then, frankly, Helms got a break because the Reagan-Mondale race was the framework for our Senate race there.
Why doesn't Ronald Reagan want Jim Hunt in Washington? Maybe it's because Jim Hunt blasted Ronald Reagan's spending cuts, and then blasted Ronald Reagan's spending cuts, and blasted Ronald Reagan's spending cuts. Maybe it's because Jim Hunt wrapped Reaganomics and said President Reagan's cuts are absolutely wrong. But what does Jim Hunt tell voters in North Carolina?
I'm committed to helping the president carry through some very strong cuts.
You can't have it both ways, Jim.
And of course, Reagan defeated Mondale by a pretty big number in North Carolina. So we were able to tie Hunt to Mondale. That helped us get what we thought was an accurate portrayal of his liberal feelings and background. But there were some great debates between the two in that race. It was a really good race.
If Jim Hunt were to somehow have bested Jesse Helms, what is the likelihood you think that Jim Hunt becomes a Democratic nominee for president at some point in the future?
Well, I think a lot of people wanted him to run. It's very difficult to say who wins those nomination contests going in. But if you look at the Bill Clinton profile, where he got nominated 8 years later, yeah, Hunt probably would have been a better candidate than Clinton, frankly.
I appreciate you letting me go a little deep on Senator Helms there. Back to your own trajectory, Charlie, what is NCPAC and how did it come to be?
NCPAC, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, was created after the 1974 Campaign Election Act, which did reform the election laws in response to Watergate, but it also created political action committees, the ability to run them, a certain amount of money you could raise in them. Actually, NCPAC was the second conservative political action committee to be formed. In late 1974, Paul Weyrich formed the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress. In early 75, Terry Dolan, myself, Roger Stone, a couple other people formed NCPAC, with Terry being the guy who ran it. And then a lot of PACs, left and right, formed. The PACs could raise money and donate it directly to campaigns. But also, a little bit later, the Supreme Court ruled in the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, they could make independent expenditures. For the 1980 election cycle, Terry Dolan latched onto that, was very creative, and NICPAC was really the first one to do significant independent expenditures in the 1980 in several Senate races, would create commercials and go in and criticize Democrat incumbent senators. In those days, if you spent $300,000 or $400,000 in a Senate race, that was a lot of money. And so that, under Terry's direction, that's what we did. I was sort of out of NICPAC management because by then I was working for Reagan and then for the Republican National Committee.
Can you talk about your connection to Richard Viguerie and also his impact on conservative politics in this era?
Richard was the funder of the conservative movement, think tank, nonprofit membership organizations, as well as political action committees and campaigns. And I had gotten to know Richard when I first came to Washington to work for Young Americans for Freedom. I became friends with him. It was clear that if you wanted an organization to succeed, if he was willing to do the fundraising for it, you had a lot better chance to succeed. One of the things I did when Helms won his Senate seat in 1972. In early 1973, I got Viguerie together with Helms and asked Richard to run Helms' direct mail fundraise for the future, and he did. But also, he was doing fundraising for some conservative PACs, and so we signed him up to do NICPAC's direct mail fundraise. A lot of those organizations didn't have access to high dollar donations. Without Richard or others like him who could do effective direct mail fundraising, they would not have survived.
By the time the 76 race rolls around, can you talk about your role with the Reagan 76 presidential campaign and what drew you to Ronald Reagan, even when that meant being part of an insurgent challenge to a sitting Republican president trying to deny nomination for a full term to Gerald Ford?
First of all, I was a conservative first, had not yet joined the group of people who would consider themselves party establishment, but I was very lucky. I was in the right place at the right time because Jesse Helms was a friend of Ronald Reagan before Helms got elected. I met Reagan through Helms, but also, more importantly, met Reagan's senior staff, Mike Deaver, Lynn Nofziger, Ed Meese, all those folks. So when Reagan decided to take on Ford and formed a campaign in the summer of 1975, they asked me to work for Reagan, which was a dream for me. Senator Helms agreed that it was okay for me to go. In fact, he and Reagan had a conversation where he said, "I'm just loaning this guy to you, Ron, and when all this is over, he's got to come back to me," you know, just good humor. Originally, I was the Midwest political director, meaning I had five Midwestern states that I was supposed to manage for the Reagan campaign. And I did that. But then when we got in political trouble, we lost the first five primaries. North Carolina became critical for Reagan to continue the campaign. We had to win North Carolina. So I got moved down to North Carolina for the last 6 weeks of the campaign to work full time there.
And Reagan makes a very game effort in 76, turns into a dramatic Republican convention. With hindsight, do you think there was something you and the Reagan forces could have done differently to actually capture that nomination? Or was it just never in the cards to be able to beat a sitting president?
Well, it was one of those things where we did about the very best we could, including taking some risks like picking Senator Dick Schweiker for vice president, hoping that would loosen up some Pennsylvania delegates. Things like that were good ideas, but we didn't get any breaks. To answer the question, there was probably a way to win New Hampshire, which we lost by 1,000 votes. And we let the expectations about winning New Hampshire get out of control. But in these national campaigns, everybody makes a lot of mistakes. The person who wins is usually the person who makes the least mistakes. It's not like you can run a perfect political campaign, especially for president.
And there were some people in the party, in the conservative movement, who by the time 1980 comes around, really wanted to see Reagan pass the torch to a new generation. But at any point in the lead up to 1980, were you sympathetic to the idea that perhaps Ronald Reagan was yesterday's conservative? Maybe the conservative forces needed a fresh face, a younger face heading into the 1980 election?
Well, that never really occurred to me. In fact, the other people who were thinking about running for president in 1980 didn't fit that bill. I mean, it was John Connally, Howard Baker, George Bush. But I always thought Reagan had another good race in him, at least one. So I went for 2 years I went over to the Republican National Committee as political director. But at the end of the 78 election, Reagan didn't exactly say, okay, I'm definitely in. But he said, go ahead and start a campaign. I'll probably run again. They asked me again, and I went and was national political director for that campaign until the time of the New Hampshire primary in 1980. No, I'm delighted to see Reagan run. And I thought what we would get out of Reagan was just what we got, a winning election and a great administration.
And what can you say about how Reagan navigated that primary in 1980? Looking back at some of the contemporary accounts, it reads in the primary that he was kind of a soft front runner, but a lot of the pundits, the D.C. conventional wisdom, was almost expecting someone to come in to take the nomination away from him. What can you share about that 1980 primary process and how Ronald Reagan secured the nomination?
When it started out, I think people thought Connally was going to be the competition and that Connally might be able to beat Reagan for the nomination. Howard Baker was a serious candidate, but he wasn't quite as conservative as a lot of the primary voters. George H.W. Bush, God bless him, was not even on the radar screen. He was 1% in the polls when we started that race. But what did happen is that we went to Iowa. Bush made a very smart gamble that he could organize grassroots every county in Iowa by like living there for 6 months. He did. We thought Reagan had a big lead. We made about half a dozen visits to the state, but nothing like tense retail campaigning. And we got upset. So we lost, although it's interesting the way vote counts go. Bush was declared the winner on election night. Reagan lost. Well, when they finally finished counting all the votes later from all the rural counties, we won by a little bit, but it was too late then to map. So that sent us into New Hampshire, basically a head-to-head race with George Bush. In those days, there was 5 weeks between Iowa and New Hampshire. And in the first polling that came out after Iowa, Bush was ahead by a few points.
From neighboring Maine.
Yeah, that was part of it. Part of it was just the momentum. And if anybody had doubts about Reagan's age or stamina or something, that losing the first contest sort of played into that. We went up to New Hampshire. We changed our tactics, put Reagan on a bus going around New Hampshire, doing the small town hall meetings and retail campaigning. Didn't have to change the message. We just had to sharpen it a little bit and draw some contrast with Bush. But we had a couple of debates up there that were very important. Reagan had come back to almost even with Bush before a League of Women Voters debate on Wednesday night before the primary. Reagan did a very good job in that debate. Looked like we picked up a little bit of momentum and might have gone ahead of Bush. But we had scheduled a Saturday night debate, now famous Nashua, New Hampshire debate. And what we had done in coming out of Iowa with the loss, John Sears, the smartest man I ever knew in politics, Reagan's campaign manager, and Jim Lake, who was the communications director, and I sort of tried to think of some creative strategies, ways to defeat Bush. Well, one of those was we thought if you could get Reagan and Bush one-on-one in a debate without Connally, Baker, Phil Crane, John Anderson, and so forth, that Reagan would shine. So we convinced the Bush people to challenge Reagan to a one-on-one debate, and they did. When we got there, John Sears had in his mind all along the strategy to say the day of the debate, you know, have Reagan say, this is not fair. We shouldn't exclude these other candidates. You guys all come to the debate. Well, Bush took the bait and said, no, we're going to be one-on-one and they can't come to the debate. And we had a very dramatic showdown at the high school in Nashua. Bush suffered for the way he handled that, but also Reagan clobbered him in the debate.
You asked me if you could make an announcement first, and I asked your permission to make an announcement myself.
Would the sound man please turn Mr. Reagan's mic off for a minute?
Is this on? Mr. Green,
did you turn that microphone
you
off?
You asked for me if you would... I am paying for this microphone, Mr. Speaker.
And Reagan ended up winning by a huge margin in New Hampshire. Along the way, getting back to my career path, there had been during that campaign tensions, or actually more than tensions, between the original Reagan California advisors, Meese, Deaver, Nofziger, Pete Hannaford, and those of us who were East Coast-based, Sears, Lake, myself, a couple other people, weren't getting along. And it troubled Reagan, and he was trying to get everybody to work together. We didn't work together. In fact, we insisted on getting Nofziger and later Deaver out of the campaign. That alienated Reagan. And so during that 5 weeks between Iowa and New Hampshire, we were up there working very hard to make sure Reagan won New Hampshire. And the California guys were working to make sure we got fired. And we did. On primary day, New Hampshire primary day in 1980, after which I went off. I ended up coming back and doing some work for the Reagan campaign in the general election on a small basis, but I went in the political consulting business that year and later years, did some Senate races, governor's races, and a few House races as a general consultant.
In 1980, a watershed election, not just in the presidential election, we talked about Ronald Reagan, but also the Senate, and well known for the first time in decades where Republicans took the Senate, knocking off double digit, I believe, Democratic incumbents, among them people who were often described as lions of the Senate, the McGoverns and the Frank Churches and the Birch Buys. And is there one or two of those Senate races in 1980 that you felt the most personally invested in, or maybe you think it was the most symbolic of what was going on that year?
What I did after leaving the Reagan campaign was sign up some Senate races for incumbent Republicans, some incumbents and some non-incumbents. But I ended up working for Arlen Specter, Mac Mathias, John East.
Pennsylvania, Maryland, North Carolina.
Yeah, and there was one other one. Florida. My favorite person, Paula Hawkins. I helped her win election to the U.S. Senate that year. I did that and a few other things. Now, again, the Reagan-Carter race turned into almost a rout for Reagan at the end, and that brought in some of those Senate races that might not otherwise have happened. But I guess I think the biggest accomplishment they had was George McGovern, defeating George McGovern, the leading liberal in the Democratic Party.
Well, let me ask a related question. 1980, a great year for Republican Senate candidates. 1986, the cycle after that for those elected in 1980, was a rotten year for Republicans. And you had fingerprints on a lot of the Republican Senate races that year, which is what happens in a partisan wave. What can you offer about how, as a consultant, as an operative, to endure a rotten cycle, high-profile losses?
First thing, my immediate analysis after we lost so much in the 86 election was, if we'd known we were going to win the Senate in 1980, we would have put up a lot better candidates who had a chance for re-election, which was true in some cases. But no, you're around politics. You don't have to be around it very long before you understand we have a very competitive two-party system, and waves come and waves go. There's some historical connection to that. The second midterm election, when a president's in power, usually is a bad year for his party, and 1986 was. I was able to pick up a couple of wins and some House races and things that year, but I was very disappointed. And Paula Hawkins lost. She lost to Bob Graham, who was one of the most popular governors in America, and he turned out to be a long-term good senator. And we almost caught him at the end, so it was some fun. But yeah, you can't get discouraged. Any consultant who goes out to win every race is kidding themselves. Now, you could just go work for safe incumbents, I guess, and pull off a big batting average, but that's not much fun, and it's not contributing anything important to your party.
And we've talked about what drew you to Ronald Reagan, Governor Reagan, in the first place, but what can you say, what did you observe about him during his 8 years in office?
Well, the important thing is that I knew that Reagan was who he said he was, and that what you see is what you get. I had gotten close enough to him personally over the 5 years before he took office to know that he sincerely believed what he said. Very nice guy, completely courteous, did believe in picking good people to work for him. When he got elected, the first thing he did by making Jim Baker chief of staff was a brilliant move. And some conservatives didn't like Baker because of his Bush background. But Reagan wanted to have people in the White House who could get things done. And it was a huge help to have Baker and the staff that he picked along with the Reaganites in the White House. But Reagan's agenda, he stuck to his agenda as much as he could. At the same time, when he had to compromise, he did. He always said, my 80% friend is not my 20% enemy. He would compromise with people if necessary to get part or most of what he wanted. And he had some terrific challenges with the recession. He and Paul Volcker had to support very high interest rates when Reagan first was elected in order to wring the inflation, even worse inflation than we have now, if people could believe it, to wring that out of the economy. But it was almost inevitable that would cause a recession. And it did for a year or more in 1982, early 83. But Reagan stuck to his guns on that. And he stuck to his principles about the tax cuts, which we did get done. Although that was a compromise, too, by the way. But in the end, the economy got good. His biggest thing, though, is that he wakes up every morning and looks in the mirror and says, what can I do today to defeat communism? Even more so than domestic issues, that was what drove him. Well, he did a pretty good job of defeating communism. The way he handled the Soviet Union, the military buildup he was able to get through Congress. Fact is, he thought if we did all the things that he wanted to do in 8 years, that someday in the future, maybe 20 years, maybe after his life, we would defeat communism. But it was 2 or 3 years after his presidency, Soviet Union collapsed.
And then also George W. Bush, you were very close to. Can you talk the political talents of George W. Bush, maybe a more well-rounded 3D portrait of George W. Bush than the two-dimensional version that is often portrayed?
Yeah, sure. I got to be friends with President Bush 43, as we call him, during his father's campaigns. In 1988, I supported Jack Kemp for president. We lost. George H.W. Bush was the nominee, so I pitched in and helped. I actually helped a lot on that campaign and the general election. In the course of that, I got to know George W. fairly well and worked with him on a number of things, stayed reasonably in touch with him after he went back down to Texas. And when he decided to run for governor, supported him. He didn't need a lot of help from me. He had the best guy in Texas at that time, Karl Rove, who turned out to be one of the best of his generation overall. But I stayed in touch with him, got to know him well. I'd say we and our wives are personal friends and have been for all those years. What he had didn't always come across was terrific intelligence, a very smart man, not always the most articulate. If he prepared a speech for a debate or something and had the lines in his head, he could be pretty good. But sometimes just ad hoc or trying to answer a question, he might not be as articulate as you want. But it didn't betray any lack of smart. In fact, I used to deal with reporters sometimes who were hostile to him. I'd finally explain it by saying, look, George W. Bush is very intelligent, not necessarily articulate. I know a lot of reporters who are very articulate, not necessarily intelligent. Didn't go over well. So he had this Bush family commitment to public service. It was almost a noblesse oblige family code, which they all abided by, which came from 41's father, really, to tell you the truth. But they believed in integrity, fair campaigns. None of them liked to go negative. We used to get 41 to go negative in a campaign, you had to convince him he was counterpunching because the other guy was pounding on him. That code of honor of the Bush family was very much present in Bush 43. He had a much different presidency than he expected. He'd been a very good governor, very innovative, good policies on the economy. One of his major priorities was to bring Hispanic Americans into the government, which he did in a very serious way, which helped the Republican Party there gain support in the Hispanic community. What he wanted to do as president was be largely a domestic economic issue president and push that Hispanic agenda that might attract some support for Republicans. Instead, up comes 9/11, and he ended up being a wartime president. Did some good things on the domestic front, education reform, tax cuts, and so forth. He had the determination about Afghanistan and Iraq. This was the way to keep more terrorists from our shores. And so he fought those wars pretty diligently, even when at least Iraq wasn't popular.
I glossed over it a little bit. I knew you were a Kemp guy in 1988 and not a George H.W. Bush guy in the primary. But given what you said about being involved in that general election, the 1988 presidential, famously, George H.W. Bush was behind double digits relatively late in the campaign. What can you share about how that race ended up being a virtual landslide?
The primary process hurt Bush. He was criticized for not being weak, for not being Reagan, not being strong enough. And Dukakis got nominated relatively unscathed, but he was actually a pretty weak candidate. So we sat down, we did a poll and sat down with it about the second week of June, 1988. We being Lee Atwater, Stu Spencer, Jim Baker, Roger Ailes, and me, and looked at this poll. We took the poll off site because we didn't want a bunch of people on the staff trying to come into the meeting. And we were 17 points behind Dukakis. But we had tested a lot of issues that if people knew some of Dukakis's liberal policies, he lost support. So we had to then figure out a way to use those issues against him. And Bush, as I said, didn't like negative advertising or negative campaigning. We had to convince him. And it took some convincing, but then we rolled out that group of issues from the ACLU to the Pledge of Allegiance to the furloughs. And you know what ended up being an important issue was Boston Harbor. They never cleaned up Boston Harbor during his time as governor. Using the conservative liberal difference on those issues, we climbed back into the race by September. We were still probably 4, 5, 6 points down when the debate started. Because we were gaining, we had a pretty good first debate and Dukakis didn't. Race was probably about even by then, but they somewhat panicked. The next thing that happened was the second debate at Pauley Pavilion in Los Angeles, which where Bernie Shaw nailed Dukakis about what if Kitty Dukakis were raped, would you give the guy the death penalty? And he choked. He choked. He went off on some abstract policy argument about how he didn't believe in the death penalty.
The first question goes to Governor Dukakis. Governor, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. We've done so in my own state, and it's one of the reasons why...
Mr. Vice President, your rebuttal.
Well, a lot of what this campaign is about, it seems to me, Bernie, gets to a question of values. And here I do have, on this particular question, a big difference with my opponent. You see, I do believe that some crimes are so heinous, so brutal... When those real brutal crimes, I do believe in the death penalty. And so we just have an honest difference of opinion. I support it, and he doesn't.
That had a huge impact. He lost over the next few days. He lost 5 or 6 points. So Bush had a lead. We started playing up to close the race. We played up the national defense foreign policy arguments that Dukakis had no experience. And then they sealed their fate by putting Dukakis in that tank with a helmet on and letting him ride around trying to look like he was strong on defense. So that was kind of nail in his coffin because, of course, Roger Ailes knew what to do with that picture.
From 17 points down to winning the race in popular vote by 8 points, a real miraculous turnaround. And your role on these races is often labeled as advisor, sort of with a capital A, or strategic advisor, senior advisor. And I'm sure it varies from campaign to campaign, of course. But can you demystify what that role is? What is a strategic advisor anyway?
Every campaign has to have a strategy. Every campaign has to be able to adapt to change their strategy when things go bad. It's like the generals say, a battle plan is great until the shooting starts, then you're probably going to have to change it. So I was always pretty good at strategy and at adapting strategy and also at persuading candidates and staff what needed to be done. I also had a pretty good track record around the country making political judgments about different states and different people. Participated some on the political side, some on the strategy side, which necessarily gets you into the messaging. I wasn't a communications person. I didn't make ads, but I helped take those polls and figure out what the messaging should be. But in all the campaigns, all the presidential campaigns in which I played a big role, I was one of 4 or 5 people. And I never wanted to take credit for having a bigger role than I did. And usually I took those amorphous titles because other than Jack Kemp's campaign, I never managed a presidential campaign, day-to-day management.
And you've managed races and have seen dozens, hundreds of races up close. Do you have the Charlie Black 101 on what separates a really effective campaign manager from the rest of the pack?
The first thing a campaign manager needs is confidence of the candidate and usually of the spouse, if there is a spouse. Secondly, people skills. Part of the management of that campaign is motivating a lot of people, some paid, some volunteer, to go do jobs and then stay in their lanes. That's the management side of it. And then third, it helps to have good financial background or ability to manage money and ability to manage the fundraising side. If you don't have, though, the people skills and the confidence of the candidate, you're going to fail.
Well, let me throw out some of the political names, figures that I know you cross paths with. You can give me a little on your experience or maybe what makes them unique, effective political figures, maybe a little bit of a lightning round. And he came up a little earlier, but I know you were close with Lee Atwater, a really mythical figure, not just in Republican politics, but in politics writ large. What can you share about what made Lee Atwater an impressive political mind?
Well, Lee was one of my best friends, and we worked together in a lot of things before his untimely demise. But Lee was very creative and very aggressive, and he had an incredible work ethic. But Lee also did talk to people and consult with people before launching off on some creative strategy. I think the role I played for him in his career was I was his sounding board, and sometimes I could knock down a bad idea as well as help him promote his good ideas. But he was a creative genius, both in strategy and in messaging. He could discern the weaknesses of the opponent, even if it didn't show in a poll, figure out some way to go get under the guy's skin or get him to make a mistake. Real political talent.
Sometimes you hear this story that at the end of his life, he expressed some regret of the tactics he ran. Is that a myth that you could debunk, or do you think there's some truth to that?
Lee did return to his Christian faith very seriously before the end of his life, and he felt like there were some people he owed apologies to, not just people in politics. There were two people that he felt like he had offended in a sinful way in politics. One was a guy named Tom Turnipseed down in South Carolina, and the other one was Michael Dukakis. And so you hear sometimes on the myth side that, oh, Atwater apologizes to Dukakis for the Willie Horton ad before he died. He didn't. Lee and the campaign didn't do the Willie Horton ad. He had nothing to apologize for there. But when Dukakis got the nomination, Lee was bragging to a bunch of reporters and said, I'm going to take the bark off that little bastard. He realized later on reflecting that that was very offensive, disrespectful, and he called Dukakis, and that's what he apologized for.
And another name that came up in the early part of our conversation is Roger Stone, a big political personality now, and you initially crossed paths with him when you were both very young men in the 70s. Was he always a wild card? Was he always kind of a strange guy, or has that developed over the years?
Oh, not as he didn't used to be as strange as he has been the last few years. But no, Roger is one of the most brilliant guys I've ever known in politics. I mean, I put him in a class with John Sears and Lee Atwater in terms of his brilliance. And I worked with him, obviously, in the Reagan campaigns. And then we were business partners. Roger, Paul Manafort and I were business partners, along with some other people, for 15 years, from 1980 till 1995. Roger got a little bit eccentric and zany as he got older. He always had this great attachment to and affection for Donald Trump. I mean, going back to the late 80s, sort of made his, no matter what he was doing for a living, one of his big goals was to get Trump elected president, which I thought was crazy and told everybody it couldn't be done. Not the only time I've ever been wrong. But Roger's, he's brilliant, but he's out of the professional mainstream the way he operates.
Well, let me ask about John Sears as well, who's come up a time or two. I think you referred to him as maybe the smartest person you ever met.
Well, John had this tremendous intellect. He was a great student of history, not just world history or U.S. history, but political history in the different states of the country. And he personally knew the players or knew all about them. John could come up with creative strategies like the Swiker nomination, or like an effort we made at the 1976 convention to force President Ford to name his running mate, the Nashua debate and inviting those candidates in at the last minute. That was pure Sears. The biggest thing was John knew something about every state and usually knew people there. So if you sat in a meeting and said, well, what are our chances of carrying Ohio versus Indiana? He would say, we can carry Indiana. Ohio is going to be tough, and here's why. And then he knew who to call up. When I had Indiana, I had those estates, he'd send me to the right people out there who not only were the right people, but who admired and respected him, so they'd let me in the door and work with me. I think Reagan would have had a hard time getting nominated in 1980 without John. If you go back and look at Reagan's announcement speech in November of 1979, which Sears wrote, in there you had not a conventional conservative laundry list of things, but this country is plagued by bigness. Big government, big labor, big business. Republicans saying that? Well, he did. And went on to explain how his policies would help bring those three big institutions back down to earth and give the people more power. But that was a Searsian thing that Reagan adopted, he bought into. Reagan had his own principles, but he was very open to good ideas.
We also mentioned Jack Kemp, and you managed the Jack Kemp race in 1988. Can you speak to what drew you to Jack Kemp and a little bit of flavor about that 1988 primary campaign of Jack Kemp?
Yeah, sure. I was lucky when I first came to Washington to get to know Jack. He'd just been elected to Congress, and traveling in conservative circles, I got to know him, got to be friends with him. Later, when I was political director of the Republican National Committee, 1977-78, Bill Brock, the chairman, said, we need an issue to run on. We need a theme to run on in the 1978 elections, and it can't just be anti-car. Well, I said, hey, by the way, my friend Jack Kemp has a tax cut proposal, which was taken seriously by some, not seriously by others. But so I got Brock and Kemp together, and we ended up making the theme of the 1978 Republican campaign, the Kemp Roth tax cuts. And we put together surrogate tours led by Jack. And make a long story short, over that time, I got to be very close to Jack. In 1980, we recruited him to be Reagan's chief surrogate. He did that. He did a very good job for us. And so we were friends, and he wanted to run for president someday. And it looked like it was going to be, there'd be an opportunity there in 1988. He knew he was a long shot. Look, he was running against a sitting vice president and the majority leader of the U.S. Senate. But Jack was, he wasn't afraid of challenges. He had a lot of courage. He was intellectually smart. And he had the right political approach that the Republican Party needed in terms of outreach to minorities, labor, things he had done in his district in New York, which weren't much done in the Republican Party in those days. And his background as a professional football player. Look, he was every day he was working with minorities in the majority of his team. So it was a natural thing for him. And that really attracted me that we might be able to lead the party. And we did lead some people toward that effort.
And aside from those who've gone on to be president, who is a Democratic political figure you've run up against or maybe just seen from afar who struck you as an incredibly impressive political talent?
Oh, gosh. A number of people. We talked about Jim Hunt some. He was a very effective governor and a good campaigner and could have been on the national stage an effective campaigner. I admire Bill Clinton for his political skills. And I get along with him personally, too. But he never could quite figure out who he was, whether he was a liberal or a centrist or to follow through on the things that he ran on. When he got in political trouble, he went for welfare reform and eventually negotiated a balanced budget agreement with Newt Gingrich and Trent Lott. So I admired Bill Clinton, although I thought he was a little schizophrenic on policy. I mentioned Bob Graham. I think Paula Hawkins would have been reelected against anybody in Florida that year except Bob Graham, one of the most popular governors in the country. And he came to the Senate, and he was sort of a left of center, but somewhat moderate senator. He did work across party lines many times. He was tireless in working for the state of Florida. So I admired him, too.
And as we wind down, I certainly want to touch on your work in governmental affairs. You started Prime Policy Group. Can you give a flavor of that firm and some of the work you've done that you're most proud of?
By the time I left the Reagan campaign in 1980, I was 32 years old and didn't have a steady job. I mean, I was going from campaign to campaign to campaign. After Reagan won, I thought about a government relations lobbying firm. I didn't want to give up doing political campaigns. So the way it ended up, we did political consulting firm and a government relations firm. And it started out with just a few of us Republicans, but we were successful. So in 1984, I decided we should become a bipartisan firm, be able to do full service, both parties, Congress and executive branch for clients. And we enlisted a prominent Democrat named Peter Kelly and another prominent one named Jim Healey. And the third one was Scott Pastrick, who's still with our firm. We became a bipartisan lobbying firm. We worked very carefully to get blue chip clients and do a thorough job for them. We turned down a lot of clients because we always wanted to be known as people of integrity. And we wouldn't tell somebody we might accomplish something if we didn't think we could. So it's a lot of people have come and gone. I don't run the firm anymore, although I still work there part time. But it's one of the better medium-sized lobbying firms in Washington with a good client list and perfect bipartisan balance.
And I read a profile of you that was written in the last few years, but it talked about this era, and I've got it written down here. In the Reagan era, the lobbying firm that you described became a powerhouse by innovating smash mouth techniques that shook up K Street. What is that article getting at?
Well, we always had, because of our campaign backgrounds, the approach we would take to lobbying was what we called the campaign model. We realized you don't just go to Congress and knock on doors and state your case. That out in the public, you had to publicize the issues. You had to sometimes develop coalitions of different groups and industries behind a proposal. You had to have constituent contact in a senator or congressman state to get their attention on your issue sometimes. So we'd do the whole thing. I don't know about smash mouth. You don't last real long in the lobbying business if you attack. Our political careers might be reflected in the way that was written, but we did use a campaign model, which everybody uses now, by the way, but which in the 80s was new. What we said is, look, we have to condition political environment and the communications with the key leaders here. And then knocking on doors on Capitol Hill is the last piece of the puzzle, which we were also good at.
And this may not be a novel observation, but if you'll indulge me, if you look at your firm of the 80s, you, Paul Manafort, Roger Stone, it does seem almost like a glimpse into the future of what the Republican Party would become 30, 40 years in the future. You, as the mainline Republican, working for people like McCain, Romney, Kasich, Manafort, someone who's maybe not a natural Trump person, but I suspect gravitated him out of some sort of pragmatic mercenary mentality. And then Roger Stone, who we talked about, is this agent provocateur, this almost jester type figure that undergirds some of the chaos around the Trump movement. So seeing how all this has played out over the last 6-8 years, does that hold water? What do you make of it?
Well, that would be one way to characterize it. What Manafort did was he sort of got out of U.S. politics for years. The 1996 campaign was the last one in which he played a significant role. He went to do international campaigns and other work and really had not done much at all until 2016, when he was asked to come in and help run the convention for Trump, then later became Trump's campaign manager. A mercenary adjective on Paul is fair. Yeah, Roger went off. He was sort of a ringleader in the conservative movement for a long time. But now what he does, it isn't even that. It's, any kind of bomb thrower that's hanging around, he wants to do something with. So what I've done was I started as a conservative Republican. I still am. We became the mainstream during the Reagan and Bush years. I think we still are. Trump upset that apple cart in terms of not being a particularly conservative guy, but rather an opportunist who did do some conservative policy objectives. And because of his conduct and personal behavior, alienated most of us who've been involved in the Republican Party for a long time. So it's a mixed bag there, but I wouldn't argue too much with that characterization.
And as someone who is identified with the Republican establishment, over the last 6-8 years, we've seen Republican voters rebel against the party establishment. And usually the conversation is about what Trump and his ilk are doing to cultivate that rebellion. But what mistakes do you think Republican establishment made that led to there being a fertile ground for the insurgency we're seeing within the Republican Party?
Well, I think the mistakes was a lack of foresight about what was developing out there. We've always had a sort of a populist element in the party, a protectionist, nativist element in the Republican Party. Witness Pat Buchanan as far back as 1992, 1996. Perot picked up on some of that running as an independent. But we've always had that element in the party. And I think what we failed to recognize was that that group was growing. There was more and more frustration with big government, with China, with those sorts of things. So a guy like Trump, a master television personality, could come along and capitalize on it. Now, Trump didn't win by getting a majority of the votes of Republicans in the primaries, but we had too big a field, and he managed to go in and get 30% here, 32% there, 35%, that he locked up enough early primaries to become the nominee. So, we underestimated both his talent and the extent of the populist movement within the party.
Who was someone you think would have been a killer lobbyist that just never went into it?
Oh, gosh, any number of people. There's a lot of people who've been in the House and Senate who just did not want to go lobby after it was over. I mean, got Jim Baker. Jim never became a lobbyist. He's a great lawyer. Jim still works at age 93, by the way, at his library and at Rice University. He goes in there a couple of times a week. He practiced law until a few years ago. He would have been the Bob Strauss of this era, but he didn't want to do it.
And you've hired a lot of people, both on campaigns and committees in your current firm and in your lobbying activities. You obviously have a good eye for talent. What have you learned over the years about hiring the right people?
Well, you have to figure out somebody that can be a team player. When I say people skills, part of that is being willing and able to work with other people, being willing to show some humility to do that, not looking out for a title or your own ego. There's plenty of credit to go around in campaigns or in lobbying firms. A good lobbying partner or a good campaign staffer is somebody who will build other people up and work with them and not be out to make their own name for themselves. When I was involved in politics around the party every day for years and years, I knew an awful lot of people. And I might pull in somebody from a state that I knew about and knew they fit that criterion that nobody else around would have known. You go through, sometimes you interview a lot of different people if you're hiring somebody you don't know. And inside the Beltway, the people that work in lobbying firms mostly come from the Hill or from another lobbying firm. So they've got track records. You need issue expertise, policy expertise on the part of most lobbyists. But you also need to know how they worked on the Hill or in their previous firm. And do they have any humility?
And just a couple of things as we wind down. There's a lot of smart people out there, a lot of people who work hard, Charlie. But what do you think has made you different? What's made you unique that you've been able to be so successful in what you've done? What's an X factor that you have that maybe some others don't?
Well, I have been in the right place at the right time throughout my life. I've been lucky to be able to work for Reagan and the Bushes and some other very fine people. But I think using my experience to gain judgment, the strategy role we talked about, a lot of that is making judgments and helping other people make judgments. And I've always seemed to be pretty good at that. Work ethic counts, discipline counts, but not everybody has good judgment.
Are there best practices you can share about being in a campaign that's in crisis mode and the bullets are flying around you that maybe some people would get frazzled and make mistakes? And what is your strategy about handling those types of situations?
Well, the first thing you have to do is figure out the facts. What happened? What really happened? What didn't happen? And how'd you get in this position? Then you do have to remain calm and talk it through with the key players, especially the candidate. Then you got to come up with a strategy to get out of the crisis. Ordinarily, that involves transparency, full disclosure. We used to say that when you get hit with a bad charge in a campaign, there's three answers, three possible answers. I didn't do it. I did it, but it's not very important. Or I did it and I won't do it again. The last one's usually the right answer.
When was the last time you played the clarinet?
Oh, my gosh. Probably right after I got out of college. At one point, I wanted to go to college and major in music. And I played clarinet up through 2 years of college. But I got, frankly, when I got involved in politics, I became attracted more to law. Maybe being a lawyer was a good thing. And I actually pictured myself being a courtroom lawyer and finished law school and passed the bar. First few years I was in Washington, I figured someday I'd go back to North Carolina and be a lawyer.
Well, I suspect there's plenty of Democratic officials, many of them former officials, who maybe would have wished you would have stuck with the clarinet a little longer, stayed out of out of politics. Is there a book you could recommend, a good insight into how you think about politics or lessons you've learned from? Is there a recommendation or two you can give as we close?
I think integrity and character is so important that I would recommend any of C.S. Lewis's books, especially Mere Christianity, which has informed me a lot. To figure out how to operate effectively, the recent book on Jim Baker by Peter Baker and Susan Glassman is very good. They really did a good job of capturing Jim, his strengths, his weaknesses, and how he operated to achieve a lot of things.
We only scratched the surface here. We didn't talk Bob Dole. We didn't talk John McCain. We could have gone on and on. This has been a real treat. If there's anyone more steeped in Republican politics, I don't know who it would be. Charlie Black, a true titan of Republican politics, thanks so much for your time.
Zach, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Pro Politics Podcast. Please subscribe so you can access each episode first thing every Tuesday morning. And if you're so inclined, leave a rating and a short review on your podcast app to help more people find this podcast. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook for updates on upcoming guests. Thanks for listening.